sunlight echoes on a river skin.
Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Okay, let's jump right in. We have a potentially shocking idea for you. What if we told you that, right now, the lining of your mouth is almost certainly colonized by microscopic cells carrying genetic mutations, mutations powerful enough to drive cancer?
It sounds a bit like science fiction, doesn't it? But it's standard biology, and that's really the core of this deep dive.
So these aren't tumors?
Not at all. Not yet, anyway. They're tiny pre-cancer clones. Think of them like miniature armies of mutant cells that they accumulate steadily as we get older.
And that's the massive challenge, right? They're invisible, not just to the naked eye, but until very, very recently, they were invisible to our best sequencing technologies.
Exactly.
So if we really want to understand cancer risk, I mean, to catch that very first molecular step before a tumor even thinks about forming, we have to be able to study these clones when they're nothing more than single molecules of DNA.
Right, in what looks like perfectly normal tissue. The problem with traditional sequencing was always this trade-off. You could either go high throughput and study thousands of people, but you'd only be sensitive enough to find clones that made up, say, 1 to 5% of the whole sample.
Which we call the variant allele fraction, or VAF.
Exactly, the VAF. So you needed a pretty big clone for the standard tools to even register it was there.
So we were missing almost everything.
We were missing the very beginning of the story. We knew somatic mutations pile up with age, influenced by, you know, internal processes and external exposures, but we just didn't have a tool that was sensitive enough and scalable enough to map it across huge populations.
But today, we're talking about a technology that does exactly that. A breakthrough that turns something as simple as a cheek swab into this unbelievably detailed map of early cancer development.
It really changes the entire game for studying somatic evolution.
And before we get into the findings, which are incredible, we have to give credit where it's due. This was a monumental effort.
It really was. This work comes from the paper, Somatic Mutation and Selection at Population Scale. So today we're celebrating the work of Andrew R.J. Lawson, Federico Obesgal, and the broader teams at the Wellcome Sanger Institute, working with the amazing Twins UK cohort.
A perfect marriage of cutting-edge tech and large-scale human data.
It is. And it all comes down to overcoming this one key technical hurdle. The natural mutation rate in a normal cell is already incredibly low, something like 10 to the minus 7 errors per base pair.
So that's the biological noise.
That's the noise. To find the signal of one tiny clone, you need your sequencing technology to be like 200 times quieter than the noise itself.
Which brings us to the star of the show, NanoSeq.
Yes, a new optimized version of it. It's a type of duplex sequencing.
Okay, so what does that actually mean, duplex sequencing?
Well, standard sequencing just reads one strand of a DNA molecule. Duplex sequencing, it reads both of the complementary strands, and it uses these unique molecular barcodes to know which two strands came from the original molecule.
So you can compare them.
You can compare them, and if the two strands don't match up perfectly...
It's probably just a technical error from the machine or the thread.
Exactly, you throw it out. But if a mutation appears on both of the original strands, you know it had to be there in the cell to begin with. It's a real somatic mutation.
That is an amazing level of rigor. So their technology has an error rate of what?
Fewer than 5 errors per billion base pairs. That's 5 × 10⁻⁹. It is so quiet, you can hear a single molecule whisper.
Wow.
And the big innovation here was making this ultra-accurate method work with standard lab techniques, like whole exome or targeted capture. They figured out new ways to prep the samples.
So what's the result of that? What does that unlock?
It means targeted NanoSeq can now quantify mutation rates and driver genes in basically any tissue, profiling hundreds of these tiny clones all at once.
And they proved it works in blood, right?
They did. In blood, we know about common drivers like DNMT3A and TET2. Standard sequencing, you know, with its VAF limit of over 1%, it just sees the very tip of the iceberg.
And with NanoSeq?
They found 100 to 200 times more driver mutations in every single sample. It just completely redefines how packed with clones our normal tissues really are.
Okay, so that's the engine they built. Now let's talk about the fuel they put in it. Over 1,000 oral epithelium samples. So, cheek swabs.
And hundreds of blood samples, all from the Twins UK cohort.
And the findings from the mouth, they're just staggering.
They really are. They found this incredibly rich selection landscape with 46 different genes showing signs of positive selection.
Meaning mutations in those genes give the cell a growth advantage.
A real advantage. And that adds up to over 62,000 estimated driver mutations across the whole cohort.
62,000.
Yeah.
Just from cheat swaps. Cool. It's hard to even picture that. And they clocked the rate, right?
Yep, they did. Mutations build up linearly with age at a rate of about 18 new single nucleotide variants per cell per year.
And this is where that sensitivity really, really matters.
It's everything. 90% of the mutations they found had a VAF of less than 0.1%.
So with standard methods,
you would have missed basically the entire story. Gone.
That's incredible. And in older people, say 65 to 85, what percentage of their cheek cells actually carry one of these drivers?
Between 10 and 20% of all their buccal cells. About 10% of cells have a driver in the NOTCH1 gene and another 3% in TP53. These are huge territories of tissue carrying what you could call precancerous potential.
And the sheer amount of data let them do something they called, what was it? In vivo saturation mutagenesis.
Yes, which is a really cool concept.
So it's kind of like running a giant natural experiment inside people instead of in a petri dish.
That's a perfect way to put it. Because they had so many mutations from so many people, they could see which specific amino acid changes were being selected for in real life. They found over 1,200 of them.
Wow.
Almost 600 in NOTCH1 alone. This is so powerful for things like, you know, classifying variants of uncertain significance, those VUS that are such a headache in clinical genomics. Now we can see which ones actually drive growth in human tissue.
And it goes the other way too. They saw negative selection.
They did. They showed that mutations that would break essential genes like SF3B1 are actively weeded out. It proves that the cellular environment is DDoM. It's tough. Not just any mutation gets a foothold. If it hurts the cell's basic functions, that clone gets suppressed.
Okay, so our tissues are this constant battlefield of microscopic clones.
Uh-huh.
But if 10 to 20% of our cheek cells have these powerful driver mutations, why don't we all get oral cancer?
That is the million-dollar question, and it brings us to growth dynamics.
Right.
So they modeled the growth of these clones and compared the ones in the mouth to the ones in blood, which we know can cause leukemia.
And they found a critical difference.
A massive difference. The blood clones, driven by genes like DNMT3A, they just grow and grow almost exponentially with age.
But not in the mouth.
In the mouth, the clones are constrained. Their growth seems to slow down or even plateau as people get older.
Constrained? That's a profound biological insight. It suggests there's some kind of defensive wall in epithelial tissue that stops these clones from taking over completely.
Exactly. And the authors think this constraint might be the single biggest barrier preventing cancer from developing in these tissues.
So it's not just about getting a mutation, it's about whether that mutation is allowed to expand.
It shifts the entire focus.
So how do things like lifestyle factors play into this? The mutational epidemiology part.
Right. So using the Twins UK data, they could link exposures to these mutation landscapes. They found two main mutational signatures. Signature A was your basic clock-like damage that comes with aging.
And signature B.
That one, SBS16, was strongly linked to alcohol and aldehyde metabolism.
So when they put it all together in their models,
the connections were crystal clear. Age, smoking, alcohol, and even poor oral health, like missing teeth, were all strongly linked to a higher mutation burden or more driver clones.
Okay, and this is where it gets really interesting for me, the role of tobacco. We think of it as causing that classic SBS4 signature.
We do, but that's not what they saw here. They suggest tobacco's main role isn't creating new random mutations through SBS4.
So what is it doing?
It seems to accelerate the other signatures, A and B, and this is the key. It changes the rules of clonal selection.
So this is the difference between a mutagen and a selectogen.
Exactly. A mutagen causes the damage. A selectogen changes the environment to give pre-existing mutants a winning edge. Smoking seems to be a powerful selectogen.
So the smoke doesn't necessarily create the NOTCH1 mutation, for example.
Right. But the inflammation and altered tissue environment it causes might give a cell that already has an NOTCH1 mutation a massive advantage to grow and expand.
That framework feels huge for prevention. We can move beyond just saying smoking is bad and start building these really detailed mechanistic risk models.
It lets you connect a specific risk factor, like alcohol, to a specific molecular consequence, like the expansion of a certain type of clone.
And these landscapes could then become, I guess, surrogate risk markers. You could test if a new drug or a lifestyle change actually slows down the growth of these dangerous clones.
That's the dream. It would be a true molecular prevention trial. This technology gives us a quantitative window into cancer risk years or even decades before a tumor forms.
So, to bring it all home.
I think the take-home message is that this combination of single-molecule sequencing and large-scale human data shows us that our normal tissues are these incredibly dynamic ecosystems. Mm. They're just teeming with microscopic clones that are being positively and negatively selected all the time.
And this technology finally gives us a roadmap to connect our lifestyles and our genetics to the very, very first steps of cancer development. Which leaves us with a really thought-provoking question for you to ponder. Given that we can now measure this risk accumulating in our normal cells, and given that our bodies seem to have their own powerful brakes to constrain these clones, do we intervene as soon as we see one? Or do we just monitor and trust that those natural defenses will hold?
And deciding when, or even if, to act on a precancerous clone that might never have become a problem, that's going to be a major clinical and ethical challenge in the coming years.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
Coded whispers to open skies.